Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting a major endorsement for the Iran nuclear deal from inside Tehran. Iran's official news agency is reporting that the Islamic Republic's military chief is backing a landmark nuclear deal with world powers despite having concerns over it. General Hassan Firouzabadi, a close ally of Iran's top leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, spoke of 16 advantages of the deal, a major endorsement that may push conservatives to join moderates in supporting the agreement despite growing opposition from hardliners. The official Iranian news agency reported his comments on Saturday. That news comes on the tail of word from Washington Friday that the White House would not be getting the endorsement of the Iran nuclear pact from one of the country's most powerful Democratic senators, the same political party as President Obama. Spokesman Josh Earnest said Friday the senator, Chuck Schumer, has had a difference of opinion with President Obama going back to 2003, referring to Schumer's vote in support for the U.S.-led war in Iraq.
That's why I would describe this as an announcement that was not particularly surprising to anybody here at the White House, even if it was disappointing.
However, said Earnest, it does not change our confidence that we will be able to mobilize substantial majorities of Democrats in both the House and the Senate in support of the deal and, if necessary, to sustain a presidential veto. In a statement explaining his concern, Schumer said the inspections regime was inadequate in the deal. More on our website. Check it out at voanews.com. This is VOA News. A wave of attacks on the Afghan army and police and U.S. special forces in Kabul have killed at least 50 people and wounded hundreds, dimming hopes that the Taliban might be weakened by a leadership struggle after their longtime leader's death. The bloodshed began Friday with a truck bomb that exploded in a heavily populated district of the capital and ended with an hours-long battle at a base used by U.S. special forces. It became the deadliest day in Kabul in years. The Islamist insurgents claimed responsibility for both the police academy attack and the battle at the special forces base, but not for the truck bomb. The scale of the violence heightened obstacles to reviving the stalled peace process and conveyed a no-compromise message from the Taliban at a delicate time following last week's revelation of Mullah Muhammad Omar's death and a dispute over the leadership of the insurgency. The father of a Palestinian toddler killed in an arson attack on his home a week ago died Saturday of wounds sustained in the fire. Suspected Jewish attackers torched the home of Saad Dawabseh in the West Bank village of Duma July 31st, killing his 18-month-old child and seriously injuring his wife and a second son, an act that Israel's prime minister described as terrorism. Meanwhile, hundreds of Palestinians rallied at Dawabseh's funeral in Duma Saturday and in Duma and called on militant factions to take revenge for the deaths. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet has come under growing pressure to crack down on violent far-right Jewish groups since the attack, and the government decided to allow harsher interrogations of suspected Jewish militants with methods once reserved for Palestinian detainees. A typhoon continues to pound southeast China late Saturday, leaving more than a million homes without power after lashing Taiwan, where it downed trees, traffic lights, and power lines, and left 6 people dead and 4 missing. Typhoon Sotolar hit the city of Putian in Fujian province late Saturday night and was expected to move across the region, according to China's official Xinhua news agency. The storm earlier had caused more than 3 million households on Taiwan to lose electricity, with streets strewn with fallen trees. All 279 domestic flights on the island were canceled Saturday, as well as at least 37 international flights. At least 101 people were injured in that storm. The United Nations is stepping up emergency aid to Myanmar, where massive floods have killed at least 88 people in the country's Irrawaddy Delta section. The UN said Friday it will contribute $9 million from Central Emergency Response Fund to help aid agencies provide assistance in the region. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
A high level of tension and anxiety, and we hear regular reports not only of gunfire or other events, but of people, including youth militias, having been amassed.
A top U.S. envoy expresses concern about the escalating political crisis in Burundi.
It's surprising to most people on this earth that professional doctors who work for the government of Ghana do not have any conditions of service. I mean, it's absurd, but that is the situation.
Ghanaian doctors embark on a strike action after talks with the government falter.
As much as it's not a major discussion on the streets in Kampala, the few people who are able to talk about it who understand the following these things are excited about the profile that Kenyatta is building in the region.
And Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is in Uganda for an official state visit. We'll have details. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa, Thomas Perriello, has just returned from a trip to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, Burundi, and Rwanda. Perriello met with government officials and opposition members in Burundi, where the United States continues to stress the importance of preserving the Arusha Accord as leaders there search for an end to political violence in that country. I asked U.S. Special Envoy Perriello to assess the situation in Burundi.
Well, we were deeply concerned. You could feel a high level of tension and anxiety, and we hear regular reports not only of gunfire or other events, but of people, including youth militias, having been amassed, ready for a spark that may or may not come. All of these are the reasons why Burundian leaders on all sides, regional leaders in the international community, have to be engaged with some urgency on finding a path forward. I think when people see a path going forward, a political path, they are less likely to resort to other means that we think could quickly escalate this situation. So we need to see leaders again on all sides calling for calm among their supporters, but even more importantly, then taking the step forward to show that there's a real chance of a political dialogue to solve this.
Some Burundians have called on the U.S. to put pressure on the government and the opposition leaders to compromise to resolve this impasse. What is your take?
The United States has been very clear that it stands ready to support any path forward and stands extremely concerned about the escalation of violence and tactics. We condemned not only the assassination of General Adolf, but the attack on the courageous human rights leader who was shot through the face just a couple of days ago. So we do continue to be engaged very directly. But ultimately, the responsibility is with Burundian leaders on all sides who need to show the courage that it takes to come back to the table to resume this dialogue and find a path forward. And regional leaders have been essential to that in the past and remain essential to that today.
Now, President Nkurunziza's government accused neighboring Rwanda of being a negative force or influence in the country, stopped short of calling them or fomenting the trouble in Burundi. When you met them, did they express such to you, and what will America possibly do about that?
Well, I think some of the rhetoric we've seen on all sides has been very positive and de-escalating, and other remarks have been more escalatory in nature. And I think right now what we most want to see from leaders on all sides is that call for calm and that commitment to a political process forward. Again, so far we have seen many, particularly in the opposition and in the military and elsewhere, hold together across ethnic lines. That's extremely important. But this is all happening in the context of a very fragile economy of over 200,000 refugees who've already left the country. These are innocent civilians who are very much at risk in a fragile country. So time is not our friend in this, and that's why I think the United States and so many in Burundi are calling for regional leadership to help support the kind of political dialogue we need going forward.
Do you think the EAC, for that matter, the African Union, are doing enough to help resolve the crisis in Burundi?
What I know is that when the EAC and the AU have shown leadership in the region, it's been extremely positive. We see that in the recent past with the Arusha Accords that helped move the country beyond war, but also at key moments in the last couple of years and couple of months. So we are urgently ready to support a resumption of that kind of strong leadership from across the region and across the AU. And that's got to happen here really in a matter of days and weeks, not months or years, if we're going to ensure that Burundi gets back on a solid path forward.
Now, let's move to Rwanda. Rwanda is a strong ally of the U.S. The democratic process there, some people have expressed concern that dissent is being stifled in that country, especially when there are calls. About 3 million people have petitioned the parliament to change the constitution that will allow President Kagame to run for an unprecedented third term. What is the message of the U.S. to the government in Kigali?
Well, President Obama spoke in forceful terms from Addis to not just any one leader, but really to all leaders around the world about the importance of strong institutions, not strong men in politics, and why constitutional term limits, including our own here in the United States, are ultimately so important for going forward. We have expressed concerns evenly across the region, including concerns about any changes to the Rwandan constitution on term limits, but also spoke directly to the concern in Burundi, calling that out by name. So President Obama has made very clear why he thinks this is an important component of constitutionalism going forward in any country, and why people anywhere in the world deserve that kind of democratic accountable governance.
When you met folks in Rwanda, what did they tell you about the democratic process in Rwanda?
Well, I think, first of all, we heard a tremendous amount of concern about instability across the border, particularly in Burundi. We've seen positive leadership, particularly from Rwanda and Tanzania, but also the DRC, on taking the refugee flows in. Unfortunately, it's not the first time these countries have had to deal with these kinds of refugee flows, and the international community greatly appreciates that. There will be a continued democratic debate there, including on the issues that you've raised. It's going to be important, like in any other country, that people have their full civic and political rights to participate.
Thomas Perriello is the U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa. He spoke with me from the State Department here in Washington, D.C. Turning to news from West Africa, Ghanaian doctors have embarked on indefinite strike after saying the government has failed to give them any condition of service despite repeated promises from the administration. The doctors suspended their services after demanding a formal document containing their conditions of service, which they say the government has yet to meet. Dr. Justice Yangsen, the Deputy General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association, or GMA, told me earlier that the doctors have withdrawn emergency services in government hospitals across the country after negotiations with officials of the administration faltered.
What we are asking for is conditions of service. It's surprising to most people on this earth that professional doctors who work for the government of Ghana do not have any conditions of service. I mean, it's absurd, but that is the situation. Unfortunately, the medical association, that is the mother association or union for all the doctors in Ghana, has been at this with the government of Ghana for close to 2 decades now. And we've gotten to a point where the doctors are saying enough is enough. And that is the main reason why this current campus is on. The doctors at their last general assembly meeting almost 9 months back.
Dr. Yangsen, some people have questioned the rationale behind the decision to go on strike at this time when Ghana is basically suffering financially. The economy appeared not to be working well. They had to apply to the IMF for a bailout. And some say that this action by the doctors are politically motivated. What do you say to that?
Unfortunately, the doctors communicated this action long before the government of the day decided to go to the IMF. The decision, as I mentioned earlier on, was first taken 9 months back. It was taken in a part of Ghana called Takrade, the capital city of the western region of Ghana. This was on 9th November 2014. At that time, government had not entered into any negotiations whatsoever with the IMF. The government had every opportunity to resolve this matter if you look at our labor at that province, what we do, even though we have been described in some quarters as essential service providers, nobody wants to follow the stipulations that the law provides. The law is very, very simple and basic. When it has to do with essential services, issues of this nature will have to be resolved civilly. Unfortunately, we've been at this for over two decades, and this is not helping matters. The other thing is that even though people talk about difficult times for Ghana, other public sector agencies within Ghana are enjoying their conditions of service. And when it's about the doctor, everybody says the situation is not good, so you can't have it. And we cannot continue this way.
You've heard comments by some Ghanaians that say that if you are really serious about your demands, then you should come together and resign en masse. That will put more pressure on the government to take appropriate measures. What do you say to such comments?
To be honest with you, we have actually communicated this position to the people of Ghana. We did that as far back as 9th November 2014, and we are still committed to that. The catch here is this. You know, for us, we believe that any patient we admitted before the onset of this action, we owe that patient a duty of care.
Some labor experts I spoke with in Ghana say that your action is illegal and that it's like putting a gun to the head of your opponent to negotiate, and that, they said, infringes on the basic labor laws in Ghana. What is your take on that?
I mean, we disagree with such people. Kindly forget about those comments. Unfortunately, the very people who claim to be labor experts are the very people who are also not advising the powers that be properly and are facing these problems. If you are a labor expert and you cannot tell the government of the day that make sure you provide conditions of service because the law says you should provide, then you are not doing yourself any good. And unfortunately, some of these same people are people who associations like the Ghana Medical Association paid money to ensure that they develop conditions of service documents that were duly submitted to the employer close to 10 years ago. The employer still hasn't made sure these things come to pass, and they still want to talk about issues of somebody doing this with a gun to the head of the government. In fact, the Ghana Medical Association, as far as we are concerned, have not breached any rules. And you'll be surprised that bodies by the National Labour Commission, who are supposed to take care of these matters, have been silent. Because they know that over the last 3 to 4 years, we have communicated these same issues to them. They haven't been able to resolve it, and they know where the source of the problem is. Look, essential services is not essential servitude. We took an oath to work, yes, but in the very basis of our working relationship with the employer is not right. Then nothing can go on. The employer has not fulfilled his part of the bargain, and he has frustrated the employer's contract. For which reason, nobody can tell us we are holding the gun to the head of the employer.
Dr. Justice Youngson is the Deputy General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association, or GMA. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is in Uganda for a three-day state visit. Kenyatta and his host are likely to discuss the latest development in South Sudan and review the situation in Burundi, where President Yoweri Museveni acted as mediator on behalf of the East African community. He is also expected to address the Ugandan parliament. My colleague Douglas Impoga spoke with Charles Mwanguhia, a Ugandan journalist, about this visit.
I'm not sure that ordinary people in Kampala are very much tuned into the visit. Local newspapers, especially the government on the New Vision, carried a lead story about this visit because since Kenyatta was elected president in Kenya, re-elected president in Kenya, this is his first state visit. And especially him coming shortly after the visit of U.S. President Barack Obama to Kenya and the discussions around regional issues, the profile and standing of Uhuru Kenyatta is reasonably high in Kampala. So as much as it's not a major discussion on the streets in Kampala, the few people who are able to talk about it, who understand the following these things, are excited about the profile that Kenyatta is building in the region.
You talk about regional security issues. How high are they on the two presidents' agenda?
My my understanding is that this is one of the major issues that's bringing Kenyatta here. Of course, they did have meetings in Addis Ababa when the U.S. President Barack Obama addressed the African Union. So both presidents were in Addis. The major issues for discussion in Kampala, during this meeting in Kampala, one is the problem of South Sudan, which affects both Uganda and Kenya almost in equal measure. There is the problem of what's happening in Burundi. It's a major issue of concern. It's high on the agenda. And, of course, one you can't avoid, which is the question of the insurgency in Somalia, where both Uganda and Kenya have troops and are directly affected by threats of terror attacks on their territories by the insurgents in Somalia.
President Kenyatta is also expected to address the Ugandan parliament. And Uganda now is preparing for elections early next year. How do you think he will be received in the Ugandan parliament?
I believe the Ugandan parliament, one, is it's been struggling over the last few weeks to raise enough quorum to pass electoral reform legislation. But both the chief whip, the government chief whip, who is a minister that is responsible for largely the NRM caucus in parliament, which is the largest, has the largest numbers in parliament, and the parliament clerks have been running advertisements and announcements on local media, television, radio, and print, urging members of parliament to come back into parliament so that they can address two things. One, attend the briefing, the address of the Kenyan president, the visiting Kenyan president. Two, pass those critical pieces of legislation. So I expect that even when this is contained mode, his visit, one, will be very symbolic, because we have President Yoweri Museveni, who is his host, who has picked nomination papers for his party, to seek his party's flag, to run for another 5-year term that will take his total to 35 years in power. We have the former Prime Minister, Amama Mbabazi, who is also a member of parliament, representing Kinshasa West constituency in parliament, who is challenging President Yoweri Museveni for the presidency of the country. And you have all this campaign going on. So we expect that his visit and his every word will be watched, especially in parliament, very closely to see what he says. If he goes the way that Obama went when addressing these African leaders in Addis Ababa a few weeks ago, I think there will be a lot of interest, and people will be looking forward to hear what he says and how he says it, given that the control of regional power seems to be shifting. President Jakaya Kikwete in Tanzania is bowing out. So the senior people you have in the East African region, you have President Museveni, who is the most senior. You have Paul Kagame in Rwanda, who is the second most senior. Then you have Kenyatta, who is like the new kid on the block, and Burundi, which is in crisis. It will be interesting to listen to what he says.
That was Charles Wanguya, a Ugandan journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from the capital, Kampala. It was a year ago on August 8th that the World Health Organization declared Ebola to be an international health emergency. The outbreak, the worst in history, has killed more than 11,000 people in West Africa. Ebola survivors have played a significant role in fighting the virus and were the focus of a conference this week in Sierra Leone. For VOA, Nina De Vries has more from the capital, Freetown.
About 13,000 people have managed to beat Ebola in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, according to WHO figures. Yusuf Kappa was one of them. He caught the virus last October during the height of the crisis. He survived, but is haunted by what he saw firsthand in the treatment centers.
I was seeing horrible things, seeing corpses, you know, people suffering, people dying.
To help former Ebola patients like himself cope, he started the Sierra Leone Association of Ebola Survivors. Kava is also trying to educate others about the virus. That kind of community engagement is believed to have played a crucial role in containing the epidemic, says Dr. Anders Nordstrom, who heads the WHO in Freetown.
What has been major challenges here actually with the trust of people in communities, believing that there are certain things you need to do, that there is a possibility to survive. So that's just for people, for families to see that there is somebody who has survived has meant, I think, enormously a lot.
Dr. Nordstrom says because survivors face so many post-Ebola issues, it was important to have an international conference to learn more about them. Health workers, scientists, and other experts came together to discuss advances in clinical care, research, and biobanking, which involves the storing of biological samples for further study. Survivors also talked about the challenges they still face, including emotional trauma, joint pain, and vision problems. Kaba says he hopes survivors can get more financial assistance because so many have lost their livelihoods from getting sick and facing stigma. The end of the crisis is in sight, with cases now a fraction of what they were a year ago, and scientists working on a possible vaccine. But Kaba hopes the world won't forget what happened to his country.
The issue of Ebola is a global issue, not just Sierra Leone.
Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Also, when news got out about an Ebola vaccine that can be 100% effective, you could just about hear the cheers from people around the world who have been following news of the horrific outbreak in West Africa. But because of the way the study was done, some people have questioned the result. Now, another study, this one with monkeys, shows the same outcome. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
In the Ebola vaccine trial in Guinea, there was no control group that was not given the vaccine, even though most scientific studies have such a group. The focus in Guinea was on saving lives. That's why an animal study by the U.S. National Institutes of Health is so important. Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the infectious disease research branch of the agency.
It showed that a vaccine that is essentially the vaccine that was used in the trial in Guinea, not only was able to protect in an experimental model in animals from 7 days prior to exposure, protected 100%, and 3 days prior to exposure was partially effective.
Dr. Fauci says the study shows the vaccine would still be effective late in the course of an outbreak when people need it most.
The other thing that was important is that it was able to protect against the multiple variants of the Ebola virus that's circulating.
There are variations for each of the four strains of Ebola virus. This vaccine protects against the Zaire strain of Ebola that has killed more than 11,000 people in West Africa. More people are likely to be infected before the outbreak ends, but so few people have the disease that trials of other Ebola vaccines have stopped. But Dr. Fauci says the research is not likely to stop.
All of us in the public health sector believe that there will be other Ebola outbreaks, and that's the reason why we need to be prepared if we had an effective vaccine available to deploy in the very beginning of this outbreak in West Africa. We likely would have saved a lot of suffering, disease, and death.
There have been 24 outbreaks of Ebola in Africa, none as devastating as this current one. And hopefully, with an effective vaccine, there will never be another one like it. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Around the world, the killing of Zimbabwe's beloved Cecil the Lion angered people and highlighted sport hunting in Africa. On Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they examine trophy hunting and what can be done to protect endangered species like lions, elephants, and rhinos. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
My brain, yo, beautiful lady, yo, that can Africa lady, yo.
Aye.
I sing in the song for Panya,
aye.
And I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything
for Panya.
Anything, yeah.
And I thank you, the Lord, for Panya.
Hey, what is my baby name? She's my fine baby,
baby, oh, eh.
She's my African lady, eh.
Lady, oh, eh.
Panya sweet like a chocolate. When she come around, she a heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate. Baby, yeah, I am. Aya, what is my baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
Aya, what is your baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
I request for my baby girl.
Panya. And I thank you the Lord for Panya.
You
must go by her for you.
Abi, hey.
Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? For my baby girl,
Panya, Panya,
Panya, Panya, scatter the fluff for me.
Sineka carry bow me pay. Oh, super back, back, back. Already wearing the crown and don't can pull me down.
It's where my time walk by. It's when you can hear you can super wire than you bet you. Sinanya who could get my chance.
Hey, but I'm a looking, 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 but I'm a looking. No matter the gallop, it's our destiny, oh, and that's what we go, they go, oh.
Fish no get feather, love we a get no get weather.
Kaki no so leather. Fish no go feather. The love we a get no go weather. Oh na 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 na. Talk to the news and all over the radio. Tell only Wally, yo. Say me too, oh, you. A beautiful girl like you, need man, like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright, man, like me. A beautiful girl like you, need man, like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, because you know, don't let that fish not get better. The love way I get, no get weather. No get weather. So, you know, don't let that fish not get better. The love way I get, no get weather. No get weather. Yeah. Baby girl, you my one and only. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anything that you want, just follow with me. No way, yeah, yeah. Say I'm your man, your salon bubble, no, yeah, yeah. Say mama, don't beat me, say for you sake, I'm ready for dying. Take bullets for you, me, I know they afraid you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Talk to the news and all about it.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Ah, tell only one,
tell you what, tell you what.
Ah, say me too, oh, you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
A beautiful girl like you, need man, like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright, man, like me. A beautiful girl like you, need man, like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright, man, like me. Because you know the leather, fish no get better. In love way I get no get weather, no get weather. So, you know the leather, fish no get better. The love way I get no go weather, no go weather. Baby, you know me, I'm your man, I can be your better man. Baby, you know me, oh. Baby, you know me, your man, I can be your better man. Baby, you know me, no. If you told me, I'd understand, but take my life away, cause you're the one, my only hope. Baby, you're the one in all. Nothing can separate me from you, no. Oh, baby, yeah. Oh, I'm a beautiful girl like you, need man, like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. Simultaneously, I try to pay close attention to developments in Africa as they affect U.S. policy. I mean, African opinions on and attitude towards the United States. This last month has been a month of many events which underscore relationship between the U.S. and Africa. The recent visit of President Obama is certainly the most striking issue because of its implications for the president's own presidency, its implications with regard to his impact in American history. It is also important with regard to what the Africans are going to say about what one scholar called it, Obama time, and how Obama time is grappled with. First of all, in looking at U.S. policy towards Africa now, you can see that American policymakers are trying to negotiate with African leaders on very delicate issues revolving around human rights. Human rights become a very important issue for the U.S. because it has implications for a number of issues that affect all of us as human beings. Because of the size and nature of American power in the world today, America is privileged in many number of ways with regard to dealing with the problem of climate change. There are skeptics who don't believe in climate change. I think there's overwhelming evidence among our scientists around the world that we humans are affecting nature. And I think our spiritual leaders at the highest level as the Pope, to all the lower level of leaders around the planet, whether they're rabbis or imams or they're Buddhist priests or they're Hindu priests or even traditional African leaders who are now sufficiently informed on all appears to have opinion. And this is one of the reasons why President Obama's visit to Kenya has a lot of historical implications. Because for his own personal biography, that's a story which many scholars have read about for years. You now begin to look at how President Obama's issue is going to affect Africa with regard to human rights. Because human rights is not an African problem. It's not a Latin American problem, an Asian problem, or a Ukraine problem. It's a human problem. So the president can only do what he can do with regard to that. And that is very much linked to climate change. Because many of the people around the world, particularly in Africa, which is this big continent with a lot of riches, but you go to Madagascar and see what is happening to Madagascar as a very big island in Africa. So American policy on Madagascar, American policy towards the Sahel areas of Africa, which was a major place. Africans were very concerned about the drought in the late 70s. And the Africans themselves went to work in developing organizations to deal with those rivers. The big problem is for African leaders to negotiate with America the question of human rights, climate change, and the bottom line of economic development. So I can summarize this narrative with three major points. Number one, with regard to human rights, the African leaders are not only dealing with dictatorship as a problem, not an African problem. It is a problem of the human beings where you have dictators. You're talking about American policy, you can see how human rights comes in many forms. In DRC, where many young women were raped, violated, and that's a story yet to be fully addressed. So you talk about human rights, military coup d'etats, dictatorships, and African responsibility. This becomes very important. That's one reason why when you look at U.S. policy towards Africa, and you talk about human rights, climate change, and economic development, then you go back to square one with regard to how all these issues are related to places like Nigeria, which is a big issue among the big five, Nigeria, DRC, South Africa, Sudan, and Ethiopia. These are the most important players with regard to Africa. So when it comes to American policy towards Africa, these five countries are very important. There are countries like Egypt, they have their own issues. That is an answer for the United States with regard to North Africa and Middle East. So when we really talk about U.S. policy towards Africa, and we're focusing on Africa's side of the Sahara, you talk about these big five and see what are they doing? Human rights, climate change, and economic development. And that's one reason why when President Buhari comes to power in Nigeria, you have a new day for the Nigerians. So when you talk about U.S. policy towards Africa, those who are seriously interested in collaborating between the U.S. and Africa are very much concerned about corruption. And that's one reason why, since President Obama came back, corruption is in the news. What can you do to get these leaders to be more democratic, to be more sympathetic to the poor people in their society, and to make sure that there is legitimate economic development? That is why climate change, human rights, and economic development are related. The Burundian situation, President Buhari, and the Nigerian condition, I have said this over and over again, the greatest obstacle to President Buhari is going to be from the elites at the top, and then the impatience of the masses who are beginning to see the diminishing value of the Naira and the building scarcity of the dollar and the rejection of the dollar among some Nigerians, if you believe the story. Finally, what one can say, President Obama's visit to Kenya adds a lot to this debate about human rights. And the debate is going to be ongoing, because because of certain changes in world history. And, of course, in American political history. So human rights is going to be a burning issue. That's the way the game is. Those leaders must recognize what Churchill said. They ride on tigers, but they refuse to dismount. And the tigers are getting hungry. Democracy is very much linked to modernization. And economic development is very much linked to scientific progress. That's the message for Africa today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, before you ridicule the old baboon of its age posture, try to count the number of hunter's arrows it has dodged or survived. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 29th, Secretary of State John Kerry's video message congratulating the Mongolian people on marking 25 years of democracy was broadcast during Mongolia's official commemoration of the 25th anniversary of democratic elections in Mongolia. Secretary Kerry said, "On behalf of President Obama and the people of the United States, I want to congratulate you, our good friends in Mongolia, on the 25th anniversary of your democracy. A quarter century ago, your country made an historic decision to follow the path of free elections, open markets, and the rule of law. It was the right decision, and it has made Mongolia a model for others in the region and for fledgling democracies worldwide. To build a democracy requires both courage and initiative, of which there is no shortage in Mongolia. In fact, I am told that you have a saying, 'If you're afraid, do not do it. If you do it, don't be afraid.' For 25 years, Mongolians have shown absolutely no fear of democracy or of the free and open debate that political liberty entails." U.S. Department of State's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Chinese and Mongolian Affairs and Taiwan Coordination, Susan Thornton, and the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia, Abraham Denmark, celebrated Mongolia's 25th anniversary of democracy with public remarks and participation in events in Ulaanbaatar coordinated by the Mongolian government. Mongolia has had six democratic elections since its peaceful democratic revolution in 1990. In her remarks, Deputy Assistant Secretary Thornton congratulated the Mongolian people on their democratic transition and reaffirmed the strong relationship between the United States and Mongolia. She said, "Mongolia's decision for democracy reflects the courage and determination of a nation of rugged individualists who want a say in how things are run. Thanks to Mongolia's decision to hold elections 25 years ago, 3 million Mongolians now have the chance to shape their government to help them realize their dreams and their goals."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.